Welcome to the April podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The April 2014 issue is on the topic of history of craniotomy, cranioplasty, and perioperative neurosurgical management. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Charles Prestigiacomo of the Neurological Institute of New Jersey, Newark, speaks with Dr. Adam Sandler of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University, Montefiore Medical Center, Bronx, New York. They discuss Dr. Sandler and colleagues' article, The Reverend Russell H. Conwell, W. Wayne Babcock, and the Soup Bone Cranioplasties of 1915.
Welcome to our readers and guests. I am Charles Prestigiacomo, one of the guest editors of this month's Neurosurgical Focus, concentrating on the history of craniotomy, cranioplasty, and perioperative care. We received a wonderful variety of articles and were particularly intrigued by Dr. Sandler's article on the Reverend Conwell, Dr. Babcock, and the soup bone cranioplasties of 1915. It is a pleasure to welcome you, Dr. Sandler, and to congratulate you and your team on this very interesting and informative and entertaining manuscript.
Thanks very much, Dr. Prestigiacomo. I feel very privileged to have been selected for this podcast. Thank you for Neurosurgical Focus as well.
Wonderful. I am sure the readers and listeners would like to know what led you to research this very interesting topic in the first place.
That's a great question. So it started about a year and a half ago. Dr. Goodrich, who's one of our attendings at Albert Einstein, asked me to help him write a review paper on materials used for cranioplasty for another journal. And while I was collecting articles about different materials that were used in cranioplasty, I came across an old review of materials for cranioplasty, and this author had mentioned briefly about this use of soup bone. And I tried to Google and search PubMed and try to find out as much as I could, and didn't find much about it, but I was intrigued by it. So I ended up writing that article with Dr. Goodrich, and then when I had a little more time, Dr. Goodrich came up to me and said, I'm co-editing this edition of Neurosurgery Focus. Do you have anything about history of craniotomy and cranioplasty? And then I had remembered about that soup bone topic. And then with a little more digging, I had found the article. The article was from 1917, and it was from Dr. Wayne Babcock, who was a very famous general surgeon. In neurosurgery, I did a year of general surgery, and I remember the Babcock forceps. And so I was very interested to know that he had been doing these cranioplasties. So I read the original paper, and the original paper said he had been at the Samaritan Hospital, which later became Temple University. Did a little bit of more research on that, and I contacted Temple University Hospital, their Medical Health Sciences Library, and they said, we have this whole archives about the Samaritan Hospital and Dr. Babcock. Dr. Babcock went on to be the chairman of the General Surgery Department at Temple for almost 40 years, so he's a very well-known figure there. And then one afternoon, I was actually on my way to Pittsburgh, and I stopped in Philadelphia. I made an appointment with the archivist, and I went through the archives and found a lot of information that would be suitable for this paper. So that's the story behind it.
Well, that's wonderful. Yes, I know Dr. Babcock himself actually started off, as you mentioned, as a GYN, and was clearly a wonderful innovator and was almost prescient in some of the neuro-based work that he did, especially with the peripheral nerves. He was pretty thoughtful in all of his decisions, right?
Yes, thoughtful, and I think also extremely creative, always thinking, to be an innovator, you have to think outside the box. I think certainly with the soup bone cranioplasty, literally going to the hospital kitchen to get material for cranioplasty, I think it bespeaks of the kind of person he was.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned is the fact that at the time cranioplasties were being done and they were using a different number of grafts that were not autografts, and they actually had some xenografts. And Dr. Babcock seemed to have used this xenograft in particular for things beyond cranioplasty. He used it, as you mentioned, for reconstructing the nasal bridge on a number of patients, some of which failed. Was there any other places where he introduced the soup bone or any other topics of, or
just,
any other objects?
Just those two split places, and you're right. Apparently, back in the early 20th century, syphilis was a very big problem, and a lot of patients with syphilis would develop what they called a saddle nose deformity. In addition, I didn't include this in the paper, but in his original paper, he was talking just about the soup bones, but he talked about the cranioplasty, their uses for cranial defects, as well as their uses to correct the nasal bridge from these syphilitic patients, and he had good results. It was a small series, the two cranioplasties and then another additional three nasal bridge implants where he used the soup bone as well.
It seemed to have been almost serendipity that he decided to use the soup bone that was actually being processed for the soup as opposed to taking one from the freezer or the refrigerator, which we could imagine now knowing the biology that we know might have been a bigger problem as far as rejection of the grafts themselves.
That's exactly right. In fact, he mentions also about boiling. Not only the boiling of the soup probably make the implant a little bit more malleable, but you're right, it probably helped against infection. So after the soup bones were boiled in the soup kettle, he then realized he needed to get the flavor of the soup off, so he boiled them again. And then this concept of boiling implants, autoclaving, that's actually what we do many ways now in terms of treating with heat rather than with cold. That's exactly right. And I think that was kind of a serendipitous action on his part, but it worked.
Was he very much involved in discussing with the other leaders of this field with regards to Maclare and Mueller? Did he talk to them, or was he just familiar with his works?
I don't know if he talked with them directly, although I will say it's very interesting. At the end of this paper, the JAMA did this discussion, which I guess these old journals used to do, almost like we have now with a letter to the editor and the letter responds, but they basically had a conversation right after his paper with Babcock and a few other surgeons where they talk about the relative merits and drawbacks of certain implants, and it's kind of funny because the first surgeon just kind of matter-of-factly states, I've never used soup bones. And then the discussion just takes off on not how crazy this was that he did it, but some guy criticizes, just like we do today, oh, you only have 2 years follow-up. How can you say this is a good implant, that 2 years is not enough? They just took for granted this innovation of the soup bone. And I didn't include it in the paper, but it's kind of a fun little discussion at the end of the original manuscript.
Interesting. Another interesting thing about this, which I'd like to touch upon, is the fact that you bring a lot of the history of the time that is just beyond the medicine, and I think that's what makes this very, very fascinating to the readers. In particular, the good reverend. He has a wonderful story that you bring out in the writing. I was just wondering, as he did contribute greatly to the hospital's founding and bringing the innovativeness of Babcock to the hospital, was this hospital, the Samaritan Hospital, was it always a non-sectarian hospital, or was it truly sectarian in the beginning?
Very interesting. I'll touch on that in a moment. But the reason I included the Reverend and the story of the Reverend, first of all, he's a fascinating character, but I think you don't get the soup bone cranioplasty if you don't get the Samaritan Hospital. And you don't get the Samaritan
Correct.
Hospital without the Reverend, because I don't think Babcock would have been able to take the liberties that he did if he was in a more established hospital. You know, when the readers will look at this paper, I mean, the hospital looked like a house.
Mm.
It's a very different community-based enterprise, and the Reverend Conwell himself was certainly not a typical reverend. A very interesting story, which I hope the readers will look at. It did claim to be a non-sectarian hospital, and it did end up receiving money from the state, but it's interesting how all of these institutions start, because as I was going through the archives, I found some very interesting discussions. So one is the hospital wants to start a nursing school, and there's a lot of debate among the hospital trustees about whether Catholic nursing students should be admitted, because this is where a Baptist school, and there was a lot of anti-Catholic sentiment, I guess, from the Baptists. There's another great description of the hospital by one of the church members who talks about how every Sunday morning, all the patients didn't have to leave their hospital beds to go to church. A telephone was brought into each room, and the receiver was placed at their pillow. And I don't know how they did this technologically, but they plugged into the church sermon. The church was called the temple. The sermon would be broadcast live to these telephones so that each patient, whether they probably wanted to or not, could hear the Reverend Conwell's sermons every Sunday. So, yes, while it claimed to be non-sectarian, it certainly had some flirtations with the Baptist faith that it started from.
One final question I'd like to ask. For the young readers of these articles, we try to publish a history topic once a year at least for the Neurosurgical Focus. Do you have any advice for the young neurosurgical residents or the young neurosurgeons or even medical students that do have a fascination with history and want to proceed with trying to do what you did, which is primary research on a topic of neurosurgical significance? Any
Sure.
words of wisdom or advice?
Yeah, I think there's tremendous opportunity for two reasons. One is neurosurgeons don't usually know their own history, and historians don't know neurosurgery. So if somebody, as a neurosurgery resident, as a medical student, or as a neurosurgery attending who knows the background of neurosurgery, there's so much opportunity untapped, I think, to explore the history of our field in ways that a historian could never really touch on. And so much of neurosurgery has not really been covered of its great history. I think there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of potential to get published, and a lot of people read these articles. They want to be read, write something interesting, and everybody will read these interesting articles because they're enjoyable. You don't have to think too hard. It's like reading a nice book.
Exactly. And one of the things that's most important is that we understand our history so that we can move forward and know where to go from whence we came. Well, once again, I would like to congratulate you and your team on this fine work, and thank you for sharing your insights into the soup bone cranioplasties, Dr. Sandler.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Thanks.
This concludes our podcast for the April issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the May issue, when the topic will be Adult Spinal Deformity, Pathophysiology, and Corrective Measures. The JNS mobile app is now available in iTunes and the Google Play Store. Just search for JNSPG to download the app for your mobile device today. For more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.